In this episode, we are going to be doing something a little different. I have two bone-chilling stories that are so beyond creepy that it'll be almost hard to believe, and it might even leave you looking at mannequins a little differently. The first story is called The Hanging Outlaw, and the second story will be called The Living Doll of Key West. I'm your host, Kendall Hudson, and this is When the Light Goes Out. Story 1, The Hanging Outlaw. In 1976, there had been an amusement park that had been known at the time as the Pike Amusement Park, formerly located in Long Beach, California. A Universal Studios television crew had been filming a show by the name of The $6 Million Man. This had been a very famous American science fiction action-adventure show starring Lee Majors as an intergalactic cyborg serving as an intelligence agent. In December of 1976, the director of this show had wanted to shift gears and shoot with a creepier atmosphere than usual, and this amusement park had the perfect ride for this episode's vision. So this film crew had driven into the Pike Amusement Park and almost immediately began setting the set up for the episode. In the episode, the bionic main character would be fighting an evil Russian spy. One of the more popular attractions that would be used for filming was called Laugh in the Dark, and this had been a horror ride at the park that often attracted a lot of other production companies to film at as well. Now, in this ride, there have been tons of props ranging from demons and ghouls to witches and zombies, but there was one wax figure that had something about it that just stood out among the rest. This was the dummy of a man that was dressed like a Western gunslinger and that hung swinging from a noose spray-painted to glow in the dark. For the previous 4 years prior to this television shoot, when tourists and visitors often rode the cart through this haunted attraction, they would come to encounter this terrifying prop hidden in the corner. Back to on the day of the television recording, the art director of The $6 Million Man had begun clearing out the space for the next scene and went to take down the hanging gunslinger dummy when one of its arms had snapped off. This was not very shocking to the art director considering that this had been nothing more than an old wax dummy. Though, after a second glance, he had seen something revealing. It was bone and tissue from what really was a mummified human corpse. Right away, the police had been called to investigate this mummified corpse that had just been discovered. It was seen at first as a potential prank, but after being examined at the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office, it was reported that the body had sustained numerous injuries and mishandling over the years, including a copper jacket bullet still lodged into its chest that had dated back to the early 20th century. After an extensive investigation led by the LA County Coroner and radiograph scans used to identify the corpse's skull, the coroner's office would discover the body being the remains of a missing Western outlaw, Elmer McCurdy. 66 years earlier, in 1910, a young man by the name of Elmer McCurdy had just moved to Oklahoma after years of running from crime. He was born in 1880 to an unknown father and to a young teenage mother named Sadie in Bangor, Maine. And early on, he had been given off to the wife and older brother of his mother, George. George had been an exceptional doctor, and Elmer had grown up believing George and his wife, Helen, were his biological parents. George would eventually succumb to tuberculosis, passing away and leaving Helen to raise Elmer and Helen's own son, Charles. Now, not long after, Sadie had moved in with Helen briefly to help raise Charles when not long after, Elmer would find out that his aunt Sadie had actually been his biological mother. Not taking this news lightly, Elmer had become rebellious, resentful, and through his teenage years would develop drinking problems, leading him to run away in 1895. Between 1895 and moving to Oklahoma, he would go on to live with his grandfather, where he would temporarily become an apprentice plumber and even move back in with his mother for a short period of time until she would pass away from a peptic ulcer, dying from peritonitis. Thereafter, followed his grandfather in death, who then died of Bry's disease. Elmer would soon begin drifting from state to state with a drinking addiction, ready for a better life of fortune, but didn't really have the means to get that desired quote-unquote life of fortune. With little money to buy food or shelter with, he had decided to develop a clever scheme, taking advantage of the common crime that fled through the Wild West at the time, train and bank heists. Most criminals in the early 1900s in the southern United States would run with established gangs where crime was way much easier to commit, although instead, Elmer would wrangle up a handful of men he'd find from plumbing or mining jobs he worked at. They would plan to rob these banks or trains in nearby areas, but then Elmer would just set his colleagues up to be caught by the local cops. Then he'd just pick up his small amount of things and skip town with the money that he had stolen. It was pretty thrilling hopping from city to city, living a life as an outlaw, but Elmer then found interest in enlisting in the army in November of 1907. He would not last long in the military, although would pick up the skill of using nitroglycerin gas, often used as an ingredient used in forms of dynamite, rockets, and missiles, and other powerful explosives. 3 years later, after laying low and being honorably discharged, Elmer would move to St. Joseph, Kansas, where he had drained all the money he had on alcohol and served a short prison sentence alongside an accomplice after being caught with tools used to burglarize homes and businesses. Elmer was found not guilty after a short incarceration, bringing him to his decision to move back to Oklahoma. On March 24th, 1911, near Leonard, Oklahoma, Elmer had been brought in by several men wanting to rob the Iron Mountain train for his quote-unquote expertise. Elmer knew that this was the perfect chance to try his skill in using nitroglycerin gas that he was taught from in the military, so the day of the heist, by poor measurement, Elmer had overused so much nitroglycerin that he blew the safe door off the train, melting the silver coins in the safe along with it. With $4,000 initially held within the train's vault, $450 had made it, being roughly about $14,000 in today's currency. Not happy about their decision inviting Elmer on board, the gang had rejected Elmer from this group, which, to no surprise, not long after, the gang had been arrested, with Elmer evading arrest with $450. Hoping to have a better chance at the second attempt, Elmer then found another gang in Kansas to plan a heist with that would be at a bank in September of 1911. With no change to the amount of nitroglycerin used in the first heist, Elmer once again blew off the door of the vault, this time not burning up most of the silver coins, but leaving to avoid capture with $150. Then came the day of October 4th, 1911. Four robbers, including Elmer, had overheard a massive amount of money being moved on a train worth $400,000 in cash. That would be about $13 million in today's currency. With guns at the ready, the four had halted the train and boarded only to find passengers sitting in the seats and post mail where there was supposed to be $400,000. Come to find out, the robbers had boarded the wrong train. The robbers would be able to flee with the accumulation of a wristwatch, a coat, mason jars of whiskey, and $46. This would be published later in papers as the smallest heist in American history. The robbers would disperse, hiding from cops, and only days later, on October 7th, 1911, cops would use bloodhounds to find Elmer hiding out in a friend's nearby barn, where a gunfight would ensue, killing Elmer on impact. After Elmer McCurdy had died, his body was sent to the local nearby funeral home, where it would remain unclaimed for weeks. The undertaker Joseph L. Johnson had been assigned to this John Doe, and had felt underpaid for keeping this unclaimed body in his care without being paid for, and he refused to bury the body. Joseph felt that if he couldn't get paid for the upkeep of this dead man, he'd take measures into his own hands. So, the undertaker then chose to embalm the corpse with an arsenic-based solution to preserve the body to keep for his own keepsake. Joseph then placed a rifle between the stiff embalmed corpse's hands, stood the body upright in a standing position, and leaned it up against the outside of his office where he would place a sign next to it that read, quote, "The bandit who wouldn't give up," unquote. Joseph would charge 5 cents for passerbys to see this bizarre attraction where they could drop their payment inside the corpse's mouth for Joseph to then collect as payment. This would continue for the next 6 years until 1916, when two mysterious men claiming to be the brothers of Elmer McCurdy came to Kansas to claim the body already given the rights over by the local cops to take back to San Francisco, California. Not long after, the body would then appear once again on display at the Traveling Patterson Carnival show as the outlaw who would never be captured alive. Elmer's corpse truly never saw rest as his embalmed corpse was sold in the 1930s to the hands of a wax crime museum owner that let his friend, an exploitative movie producer by the name of Darwin Esper, use the body to market it in his low-budget 1933 film, Narcotic. Ironically, at this point, the shriveled-up old corpse of Elmer had stayed on public display in the movie theaters to mimic a dead gunslinger that committed suicide in a police raid that had a drug addiction. And as time passed on, the body would continue to deteriorate more and more. And then, 1949 came when the standing owner of Elder's mummified body had passed away, leaving the owner's wax figurines, along with Elmer's body, to be placed in storage for another 20 years, other than being used once as a set piece in the 1967 horror movie, She Freak. A short couple years after, a Hollywood wax museum owner by the name of Sunny Sy had bought the wax figurines from the deceased owner's company, including the body of Elder, to which he found to not be authentic looking enough, and he sold the annoyingly dead corpse to Long Beach, California's Pike Amusement Park, where the art director from the television series The $6 Million Man would discover the hanging prop of the Laugh in the Dark haunted attraction to be a deceased corpse of the outlaw, Elmer McCurdy. Elmer McCurdy's body would finally be put to rest on February of 1977 in the Summit View Cemetery in Guthrie, Oklahoma. You can actually Google photos of the embalmed body of Elmer McCurdy, and it will also be posted on the show's Instagram at WTLGOpodcast. Story 2, The Living Doll of Key West. A quick warning. This tale does briefly cover sensitive topics that some listeners may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Maria Elena Malago de Hoyos, who often went by Elena, was a young Cuban-American woman born and raised in Key West, Florida in 1909 to a Floridian cigar maker by the name of Francisco Hoyos and a mother, Aurora Malaga. Elena was raised as a devout Catholic and pretty much led an all-around normal childhood and adolescence. She loved cooking with her friends and relatives, enjoyed watching Rudolph Valentino movies, and going out to dance at a social club called La Brisa. Elena was said to have been this stunning, picture-perfect young woman with a beautiful smile and voluminous long, dark, curly hair, and had caught so many people's attention that even tourists of Key West would stop to take pictures with her. Although Elena was more on the shy side, she loved the compliments and aspiring dreams of one day becoming a famous singer. Just at the age of 16, Elena would meet a man by the name of Louis Mesa. And not long after, in 1926, at the age of 17, she and Louis would fall in love, get married, and quickly be expecting their firstborn. From all accounts, Elena had been living the life that she had always longed for and felt that she was always getting closer to her dream, although soon that would all change. Only months into Elena's pregnancy, she would have a miscarriage following an ever-growing cough that would become difficult to contain. Her family had initially assumed that the illness Elena had been experiencing grew from the loss of her child, although, as time had went on, the cough only progressed. Elena's marriage with Louis Mesa would also start to fall apart, and Mesa would eventually move to Miami, leaving his wife to continue to only become more ill, and after a couple of doctor visits, Elena would learn that she had been diagnosed with tuberculosis. Tuberculosis was a pretty common illness at the time, and most common cause of death with places like cigar factories where Elena's father worked being a hub for the spread of the fatal disease. On April 22, 1930, now 20 years old, Elena had walked into the U.S. Marine Hospital for testing with her mother, Aurora, when Elena had met 50-year-old radiologist Carl Tanzler, who also went by Count Carl von Kossel. Instantly, when Dr. Tanzler met the young patient, he knew right away that he was destined to be the one to cure Elena of her tuberculosis. With all the belief that Elena had in him, Carl would fixate his day-to-day work to make sure Elena was comfortable, consistently being treated, and even started bringing x-ray equipment to her parents' home to treat her instead of having her commute to the hospital. Over the next 18 months, Tanzler would shower Elena with new clothes, jewelry, and offered services of free charge. As Elena's family did not have much money to offer for her treatments, the family had really no position to deny. Only after so long, the boundaries started getting crossed, and very fast. Carl soon began making it no secret that he was falling deeply in love with his patient. He would always come over to her home in moments when he didn't need to be there. He would make several proposal attempts and even allegedly stored a wingless airplane on the hospital grounds that he named Countess Elena. There is no evidence to show that Elena ever reciprocated her love to Carl. Matter of fact, later Elena's older sister, Nana Medina, would also state in the Miami Herald, quote, "She never loved him. She was only nice to him because my mother told her she should be kind to those who were kind to her. She looked upon von Kossel as a grandfather, and when he proposed marriage, she always told him, 'You're too old. Why? You old enough to be my grandfather. What's more, I do not love you.'" Unquote. Tragically, on October 25th, 1931, a little over after a year of her diagnosis, Elena de Hoyos would succumb to her illnesses, being laid to rest at the age of 22. Heartbroken, Carl would sign Elena's cause of death certificate as a series of violent seizures clinically associated with dormant epilepsy. Despite how Elena's family felt about Carl, he would pay for her funeral costs and insisted that he would purchase the plot for her remains, which would end up being a very expensive stone mausoleum. For the next 2 years, Carl Tanzler would visit Elena every evening, serenading her grave with bouquets of flowers. He would sing Spanish songs that she often listened to, and even reportedly heard Elena's spirit speak to him when he'd serenade her grave. If you've been keeping up this far, you probably have guessed that Carl Tanzler had an unhealthy obsession for this young woman, and unfortunately, things only got much worse with his obsession for Elena, even after her passing. Before I go any further, let's jump over to who this very strange radiologist was. Carl Tanzler was born George Carl Tanzler on February 8, 1877, in Dresden, Germany, and very early on in his childhood had claimed to have had dreams of being visited by a dead ancestor by the name of Count Anna Constantina von Kossel. In these dreams, he would be shown from his dead ancestor the face of his one true love, and from then on would never forget the face of the woman he'd be destined to love and cherish. After graduating from a medical university, he left to live in Australia, where during World War I had claimed in a journal he had wrote to have ended up in an internment camp for safekeeping because of his German heritage. Sometime after the war in the 1920s, Carl had returned to Germany, where he would marry Doris Schaefer, and by 1926, moved him and his family to America, where they settled in Cypher Hills, Florida. The next year, with his background in the medical field, Carl would be accepted as a radiologist technician at the U.S. Marine Hospital in Key West. Now still married, Carl would eventually grow distant from his wife and children, only several years later coming face to face with a woman that he had recalled his dead relative presenting to him at a younger age. This would obviously be that of Maria Elena Melargo de Hoyos. Shortly after Elena's death and Carl's consistent visits to her gravesite, Carl talked the family into giving him residence to her bedroom, paying them $20 a month, which is roughly $350 in today's currency. Still, day after day, Carl paid visit to Elena's grave when one day, not long after Carl was fired from the U.S. Marine Hospital, his visits had noticeably stopped. This change was a huge relief and a breath of fresh air for Elena's loved ones, as they could finally mourn without having Carl consistently visiting her grave. But it only took another 7 years to pass before Elena's older sister, Medina, would be the one to uncover the chilling reason why. Fast forward to October of 1940. Lots of rumors had spread around town of Carl's suspicious livelihood after ceasing to visit Elena's grave and going radio silent from the rest of the world. Worried by these rumors, Elena's sister Medina began growing more and more suspicious herself and owed it to her late sister at least to investigate these rumors. When Medina had asked Carl for access to her sister's mausoleum, Carl would consistently object, so Medina had taken it upon herself to pay a visit to Carl's home to hopefully get some answers out of him, and she would get way much more than she had bargained for. As Carl had relented to letting Medina into his home at first, he finally gave in, and once she had stepped into the home, instantly she had been hit with a terrible stench that filled throughout the house. Leading Medina to the second floor, Medina stood in complete horror when, at first sight, she had seen the painted corpse of her late sister Elena, and immediately Medina had called the police. For 7 years, Carl had kept Elena's body as his own living doll. Back in April of 1933, one day after Carl had serenaded Elena's grave, Carl would claim that he had been visited once more by Elena's ghost when, according to Carl, had told him to take her home with him. That same day, later that evening, Carl crept into the Key West Cemetery and removed Elena's body from her tomb and wheeled her home in a toy wagon. It unfortunately wasn't until years after when neighbors noticed that Carl continuously kept bringing home female clothes and feminine products, and a young boy in the neighborhood had reported seeing what seemed to be Carl dancing with a large doll one night in a partially covered window. Carl Tanzler was very forthcoming to both Elena's family and the police about what he had done. With Elena had been already dead for 2 years, her body was in very poor shape, so Carl would pick away at each maggot, fasten her limbs to her torso with piano wire, then replaced her real eyes with glass eyes and decaying skin with silk fabric that he soaked in wax and plaster. He then doused the body into a bath of disinfectants and perfume to cover the odor of rotting flesh. And as a final addition to what Carl had done, he had made a death mask made with feminine features that he had placed over the face, revealing nothing more than the eyes made of glass. Carl would dress her up to his liking and for years kept her right next to him in bed, rotting where he also slept. There was also allegedly evidence to suggest that Carl had engaged in necrophilia with the corpse by inserting a paper tube found lodged in the body's vagina to make the penetration easier. Carl would be quickly arrested for, quote, wantonly and maliciously destroying a grave and removing a body without authorization, unquote, according to Atlas Obscura. Despite the harassment Carl ensued on Elena during and after death, Psychiatrists examined him and declared him sane and competent to stand trial. During Carl Tanzer's trial, he would testify saying, quote, I wanted to take Elena high into the stratosphere so that the radiation from outer space could penetrate her tissues and restore life into her solemnate form, unquote. Eventually, all charges against Carl were dropped, being that by the time of Carl's arrest, the statute of limitations had expired. Even after trial, Carl still questioned if he'd be allowed to repossess the body, to which officials declined. Elena's body would be reburied in a secret unmarked grave. Carl would go on to live a quiet life alone thereafter for the next 12 years. In Carl's final diary entry, he wrote, quote, human jealousy has robbed me of the body of my Elena, yet divine happiness is flowing through me, for she survived death. Forever and ever, she was with me, unquote. Several weeks after Carl's death, his body was found in his apartment where lying close by laid the death mask closely resembling that of Maria Elena Melargo de Hoyos. The tale of Elena Hoyos has been told universally for over 80 years, and I found that it was very compelling to share in my own narrative because so much of the retellings of the story that I found seem to have been given the case a sense of romance and lust, and some even suggest Elena truly loved Carl, which is the false telling of this case. This is a case where a young woman with an unfortunate illness ended up in the hands of a true monster. This concludes our double feature of The Hanging Outlaw and The Living Doll of Key West. Thank you all so much for tuning in to this episode. If you like what you're hearing so far, please don't forget to like and subscribe. Also, you can follow the show on Instagram at WTLGOPodcast, where we always post all of the things that we talk about on the show and much more. With that said, I'm Kendall Hudson, and I'll see you next when the light goes out.